This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
The debate.
Most intense hostilities in 7 years. At least 60 Palestinians killed in Gaza, including 5 women and 16 children, as of now, and 6 in Israel, including an Israeli soldier. Israel is attacking the Gaza Strip with the same aggression it attacked Palestinians in Jerusalem outlets. Palestinians' only rescue card, the Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas from the Gaza Strip, who have penetrated Israel's U.S.-paid Iron Dome missile defense system. Stay tuned to another edition of The Debate. Let me introduce our guests for this debate. We have Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator at Samadun, who joins us from Vancouver. Welcome. And we also have Robert Fantino, who's an author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. So, Charlotte Cates, let me first start with you and get your reaction. The most intense hostilities in 7 years, as I mentioned. You have about 60 Palestinians killed, 5 women, 16 children. And then on the Israeli side, you have 6, including an Israeli soldier.
These attacks that are taking place on Palestine are attacks that are not just taking place at the hands of the United States. We have to be at the hands of Israel. We need to be very clear that the United States and every other country that continues to justify and support the Zionist settler colonial project in Palestine is fully complicit in the crimes taking place, is fully complicit in the forced evictions in Sheikh Jarrah that are being attempted, is fully complicit in the attacks on Al-Aqsa, is fully complicit in the attacks on Gaza. The crimes and crimes against humanity that are being inflicted upon the Palestinian people, you know, did not just start this week, have been continuing for 73 years. This week also marks the anniversary of the Nakba, in which we know that for 73 years, Palestinians have been struggling to live in their homelands, reclaim their rights, to return and to liberate their land from a settler colonial occupation that is based on dispossession, destruction, and devastation of the land and people of Palestine. And this week makes it incredibly clear that international action is critical to support the Palestinian people and stand with their brave resistance in this very important moment and crisis of conscience for the world.
Fantina, Israel has been holding aerial raids at this point, even prior to us coming on air, onto the Gaza Strip, which basically has about 2 million in terms of its population, and it's 362 square kilometers, ranking it as the third most densely populated place in the world. So basically, if you drop a bomb, you're sure to kill people. That's one point that I'd like to get your reaction on. And second, a simple question that perhaps many are not asking, whether it's through the media or elsewhere. Why is Israel killing Palestinians right now?
Well, in response to your first question, yes, Israel knows very well that the bombs that it drops are going to be extremely destructive. There are going to be many, many casualties. But that's in keeping with Israeli government policy, which sees Israelis and Israeli Jews only as superior and everyone else as inferior, especially Palestinians. So by killing more of them, by bombing the Gaza Strip, this is in keeping with their policies of genocide and ethnic cleansing. So that's a main issue there. The reason for the current onslaught is, again, started by Israel, and as your other commentator said, many other nations of the world are complicit. During Ramadan, the sacred month, many Palestinians were deprived of their right, their religious right, to go and pray and worship at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the Israeli settlers and soldiers entered the mosque, set off stun guns, gas guns. They assaulted people who were praying and worshiping completely unprovoked. And this led to resistance by Palestinians in Jerusalem. This has expanded as Hamas and the government in the Gaza Strip has decided to retaliate against these criminal activities, these criminal actions. So, as always, the U.S., supported by the United States and with weaponry provided by the United States, is now massacring Palestinians in Gaza. This will continue for some time. It's tragic, and the international community must step up to stop it.
Well, let's take a look at what U.S. Politicians have said on this, and if I may address this to you, Charlotte Cates. Looking at, let me take a pick here. Okay, I'm going to ask you about what the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has said, imploring on Israel to avoid civilian deaths. And this is while he was defending Israel's right to attack Gaza. And he said, quote, "I think Israel has an extra burden in trying to do everything they possibly can to avoid civilian casualties, even as it is rightfully responding in the defense of its people." And he said, the images of dead Palestinian children are harrowing. Correct me if I'm wrong, Charlotte Case, but isn't the U.S. providing Israel with some of those jets that is bombing Gaza?
Absolutely. I mean, Israel is funded, armed by the United States, and the United States gives Israel over $3.8 billion in aid each year, and that aid is all directed specifically toward arming the Israeli military that is responsible for these atrocities taking place against Palestinians. If Blinken and the U.S. government were actually concerned about the lives of Palestinians, about the rights of Palestinians to their homes and lands and lives, then they would cut U.S. aid to Israel. They would stop this aid. But instead, the United States has resisted even the mildest attempts to condition that aid. There have been attempts by members of Congress to introduce legislation to put some conditions on U.S. aid to Israel in terms of its use in support of illegal settlements, or its use in, specifically in the targeting and imprisonment of children. And even this has been rejected. And so, what, you know, any kind of stated concern about Palestinian lives while continuing to arm and fund and even block international action in the United Nations Security Council on the part of the U.S. government just really reveals their hypocrisy in this regard. The reality is that it's Palestinians who have the right to resist. Palestinians are an occupied people, and under international law, including as recognized by UN resolutions, occupied people and people fighting colonialism have a right to resist and seek their liberation by all means necessary, including explicitly armed struggle. And so it's in fact Israel that has no right to engage in such military attacks, because the whole purpose of such attacks is defending an illegitimate occupation that is based on a racist ideology of Zionism and settler colonialism and targeting of the Palestinian people. So, in fact, the situation is entirely backwards from the way that Blinken has portrayed it. But, of course, the United States does not want to see itself held responsible for its war crimes and crimes against humanity, not only being conducted in Palestine, but in Iraq and throughout the region.
Robert Fantina, let's look at some of the statements coming from Israeli officials. Israel's Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, he vowed more attacks on Hamas and other groups in Gaza. He said to bring total long-term quiet before considering a ceasefire. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, quote, "This is just the beginning. We will deliver them blows that they have not dreamt of." Now, when you hear that, doesn't it sound like they're thirsty for Palestinian blood?
Absolutely. They want Palestinians to die. As I mentioned before, it is a genocidal regime, Israel is, and they want to destroy all the Palestinians. They've been doing that for over 70 years now, killing them, driving them out of Palestine, driving them into refugee camps. They're happy to be killing Palestinians. We remember from 2014, during that onslaught, we saw Israeli Zionists cheering as bombs were dropping on Gaza. This is absolutely unspeakable. It's so inhumane. But the leaders of Israel are leading that charge and leading those cheers, and are motivating their people to more bloodthirsty activities. It's interesting to note also that this is perhaps a distraction from Netanyahu's many problems. There are riots going on throughout Israel as Arabs and and Israelis are clashing in the streets. Netanyahu is, of course, being tried on corruption charges. He's been unable to establish a government. There is great disarray in Israel, and bombing Gaza is something many Zionists, not all Israelis certainly, but all Zionists get behind, and that is his base, that is who he wants to please. And if he can distract them from the internal problems by these bloodthirsty statements and actions, then he will do so.
Well, there's a problem over here, Charlotte Gates, that we're almost looking like a copycat scenario. I mean, it's not like the first time we're looking at this at a war between... of course, the media is refraining from saying this is a war, but it's not the first time we're seeing this unfold. We've seen three of them. And, you know, you have the usual scenario almost playing out each and every time. And it really goes beyond this now. And my question to you is, what can be done? I mean, at this point, it's the third day. You've had these statements coming from Israeli officials that, you know, there's going to be quiet there, and we're going to do something to you that you've never dreamed of. Sounds like there's going to be more deaths. What can be done? And of course, the U.N. Security Council emergency sessions, Arab League emergency sessions, or the Arab countries, I'm putting a whole lot on a plate here. None of that panned out in the previous wars, and here we are again.
Absolutely. I mean, just to be clear, one thing that has really emerged in the current situation that has made itself extremely clear is the unity of the Palestinian people throughout occupied Palestine, from the river to the sea. And so it's very important to note that Palestinians in Gaza are not alone and separated, despite all of the siege and the walls and the occupation that has been imposed on Palestine for the past 73 years. Palestinians in Gaza are not alone. This is taking place in clear connection to a struggle that is happening in Jerusalem to fight back against land confiscation and home demolitions and the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem. And inside occupied Palestine 48, in Alid, in Ramleh, in Haifa, in Nasra, Palestinians en masse are taking to the streets and are fighting back by all means against the occupation that has occupied their land since 1948. So it's exposing the lie of, you know, quote unquote, equality inside settler colonial Israel when there has never been such equality. And the entire state is based on the rejection of Palestinian existence and identity. So the unity of the Palestinian people throughout occupied Palestine, but also in exile and diaspora, is very clear. I mean, just yesterday, there were over 5,000 people filling the streets of New York. There were 1,000 people in Berlin this weekend. There are at our website, samidun.net, we maintain a resource of international events, and there are just dozens and dozens of protests and actions and demonstrations led by the Palestinian community outside Palestine and also by international supporters of justice and dignity for the Palestinian people that are taking place everywhere around the world. And so it's so important that we stand with and support the Palestinian resistance, because we know that it is the Palestinian people and their resistance that are going to make the difference, that are going to be able to liberate Palestine. And it's the actions of the resistance and the people that are going to be the things that push the UN Security Council or the Arab League to actually do something instead of just issuing empty statements or being blocked by the United States' veto. And so that's why it's so important that we take action to try to fight back against complicity however we can. So that means taking the streets, going to demonstrations, making it impossible to conduct business as usual so long as the Israeli violence and settler colonialism against the Palestinian people continues, and also by building the boycott movement against Israel. Because, you know, and that includes sanctions on Israel, that includes a military embargo, that includes stopping this endless flow of aid and military support to the Zionist occupation that is taking Palestinian lives. By popular mobilization of the people of the world, we can fight back to change what our governments are doing by making it not possible to keep on the same path of continuing the destruction of Palestinians. And that's how we can support the most important and necessary thing, which is what the Palestinian people and their resistance are doing on the ground to struggle for liberation.
Well, you talk about the boycott of Israeli goods, and perhaps the BDS issue or topic should come into the picture over here, Robert Fantina. And let me direct that topic through the EU lens. The EU has come out saying that Israelis and Palestinians have to immediately stop and halt their violence in order to prevent a broader conflict that will impact civilian populations. That's what the EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell issued as a warning, which I think is a little bit late for that. I mean, the EU comes out saying it's dismayed at the large number of civilian deaths and injuries. EU always comes out making statements regarding the Israeli violations. The EU is Israel's largest trading partner. Doesn't that give EU a leverage over Israel in that respect, that it can do something to prevent Israel from carrying out these airstrikes, and hence the BDS notion can come into that?
It definitely gives the EU leverage that the EU refuses to use. It's the same with the United States. The United States could end the occupation today by cutting all aid to Israel and sanctioning it, and the United States government is not hesitant to sanction nations that displease it. So it could certainly do the same with Israel, as the EU could also. But they, as you mentioned, it's Israel's largest trading partner. They like the trade, they like the profits, and they are willing to overlook these atrocious human rights violations, these crimes against humanity, these continued violations of international law, so that the profits will keep on streaming in. This is one of the problems that are one of the issues that's similar in the United States. It's not so much the profits, that's part of it, but it's the pro-Israel lobbies that donate so much money to elected officials and then write legislation for those officials to introduce and vote on. But it's not only the EU and the United States, but all countries that deal with Israel can issue sanctions, they can reduce trade, there are many steps they can take, many diplomatic steps they can take. The EU is talking about a possible escalation of the so-called war between Israel and Palestine. Israel has one of the most powerful countries in the world, backed by the most powerful. Palestine has no army, navy, or air force. The Gaza is blockaded. The West Bank, Jerusalem are fully occupied. This is not an equal war. This is simply a slaughter by one powerful nation and the brave and courageous resistance by its victim nation.
Yeah, but at the same time, Charlotte Gates, we're looking at how the Gaza resistance fighters have launched, from different factions, have launched more than 1,000 rockets to Israel. I mean, we are looking at the retaliatory attacks coming through these rockets that's being fired towards Israeli cities. The Iron Dome system of Israel has failed to intercept all of these rockets, which may indicate that these rockets are somewhat more advanced than previous times. And what's worse is that we have reports that 15 of these rockets were actually headed towards Dimona, which is where Israel's nuclear reactor is. So we can see how this is getting out of hand. I'm guessing if I was Israel and its officials, that it would recalculate the war strategy here, given the fact that you're looking at all these rockets coming and some to have hit Tel Aviv.
I mean, clearly the resistance is engaging in these kind of deterrent attacks in order to protect the Palestinian people, in order to provide a form of protection that has been denied Palestinians for not only 73 years of Nakba, but 100 years of colonialism. And so that is the purpose of the Palestinian resistance, you know, first and foremost, is to protect and defend the Palestinian people. Now, the Israeli regime has been dedicated to attempting to kind of wipe out all forms of Palestinian resistance for, again, over 73 years. And what it must come to terms with is that it is not possible to do that. And just like it is not possible to erase the Palestinian people from this land, it is not possible to erase the Palestinian identity from this land, and it is not possible to stop a people from defending themselves and protecting themselves against a massive military machine that is backed by the most powerful military machine in the world. And so, yes, It is 100% true that the Israeli state, the Zionist regime, is completely responsible for every single death and injury that may befall any Israeli citizen or soldier. They are responsible for this by continuing this ongoing policy of ethnic cleansing, mass bombing, siege, denial of the right to return, mass incarceration, home demolitions, land confiscation, and destruction of the Palestinian people. And so in, you know, every single Israeli casualty is the responsibility of the Israeli state, is the responsibility of Zionist war policies, is the responsibility of those war crimes. And so it is the blood of those Israelis is on the hands of Netanyahu and the fascist Israeli leadership. The Palestinian resistance are defending their people against occupation and oppression.
Final question, Robert Fantina. Obviously, there are core issues in terms of the conflict between Israel and Palestinians that need to be resolved. That is a given. There is no peace process at this point going on. That so-called deal of the century, I think, is dead. It was dead to begin with, based on many analysts, in terms of how Trump came out with that. So, how can we move towards that? Who will be, what will be the catalyst to put these two in any type of a peace motion so that what we're looking at now does not happen?
What's required, again, is adherence to international law, which Israel refuses to do. That's why the other countries in the world must sanction and boycott Israel until Israel adheres to international law and stops, removes the almost 600,000 illegal settlers, ends all the checkpoints, ends the blockade, and retreats to its UN-established borders. Now, we can talk about if those borders are legitimate, but that's another issue. But for now, Israel negotiations are meaningless. They're unimportant. Negotiations are impossible when between two nations, when one can take whatever it wants with complete impunity and is not willing to give up anything. So those negotiations went on for years with no progress for the Palestinians. They're nonsense. They should not be restarted. What has to happen is that the people around the world need to force their governments to force Israel to adhere to international law. That's why it's important for people who are fighting for Kashmiri rights. That's why it's important for people who are supporting the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States, and the people who are the pro-Palestinian people around the world, to join forces to bring justice to the beleaguered people who are victimized by powerful nations that are willing to overlook their rights in the name of power and profits. So it will be has to be a people's movement. We have seen the governments themselves not take action. The people must take actions to force their governments to do the right thing.
Great. Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Robert Fantina, we appreciate your input here. Author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario. Charlotte Cates, thank you. International coordinator at, let me make sure I pronounce this properly, Samidun. From Vancouver. Thank you so much for your contribution. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye until next time.
That Allama Amini has been regarded as a personality to whom many authorities have been attracted, both Muslim and non-Muslim. I don't say, well, I mean, both Shia and non-Shia, no, both Muslim and non-Muslim.
Allama Amini was an extraordinary scholar who never agreed on a little things, even when you look at the book Al-Ghadir, and he has other books as well. So it shows his devotion towards Islam, how sincere he was, and how much he was very much involved in the knowledge and learning the knowledge.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. In this episode, we want to talk about Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, the great author of the book Al-Ghadir. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts, one from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and another, a faculty member of the University of Qom, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Dr. Fakhr Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum.
Okay, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, for this episode, let's talk about Al-Ghadir itself a little bit more. We can say, talk a little bit about the method of the research of Allama Amini in this book for us. We can say, for example, in finding the references to the main stories in that book, what methodology did he apply?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, what we can see in his life, the way it's been said by his close, we can say like friends and the family members, he used to travel in order to find different books. And that was the method of finding a book at that time, obviously. And we can see, like, for example, in 1380 Hijri, he went to India.
Okay.
He was there for 4 months. And after that, in 84, he went to the to Syria, where obviously there was a bigger library in the Damascus.
Yes.
After that, he went to Turkey. And the same way, he was traveling around the world or this area wherever he could, wherever he got a news that there is a manuscript which can help him.
Okay.
For example, like even like we have some stories from he himself has said some of his experiences.
That's
about
right.
Collecting the books. For example, there was a book which is Rabi'ul Abrar, and it is written by Zamakhshari, and there were only three or four manuscripts at that time. One was in Damascus, one was in Yemen, and one was near one of the scholars in Najaf. That scholar passed away, and he says like he went to his son to borrow the book.
Yes.
The son of that scholar did not agree on giving the book. So he was very much upset. So he went to the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and he said all the things that happened to him,
yes,
like he's not giving the book and this and that. And this is your topic.
Okay.
The way he said, like I said to Imam, that it's your topic, Ghadir,
mm-hmm,
and I'm trying to bring
develop a book on you. That's right.
So you need to help me.
Okay.
And then he said, like in the night, I've seen Imam, in which Imam said, like go to the Karbala and ask like my son.
Yes.
So he said the very next day I went to Karbala, I prayed the morning prayers over there, and I was just thinking about the topic, like why Imam has sent me over here. At the same time I saw the Imam of the shrine of Imam Hussein, the one who leads the prayer.
Yeah,
he was a very famous speaker.
Okay.
And he took him to his house. When he took him to his house, he showed him his library, personal library, and there he found the same book,
Rabi'ul Abrar,
and it was the fourth volume.
Oh.
And that guy, he said to him, like he said to him, his name was Sheikh Abul Hub. He said to Allama Amini that this book was gifted by someone from Syria, because he was a famous speaker in the shrine of Imam Hussein. So someone has gifted him, and at that time he just wrote on the book, and it's written on the book on the first page of book that it is gifted to Amini from him, because Imam has sent him towards me.
Oh.
So there are many stories like this.
That's right.
And we can see like the manuscripts, the way he were after them, and the way he was so much dedicated. Obviously, it needs a lot of, we can say, dedication.
That's right.
And seriousness. And obviously, Allah helps.
Yes.
Allah definitely helps. And one thing I just want to mention as well, like, for example, in order to write a 20-volume books, we can imagine how many books a person should read.
Yes.
Minimum of 10,000 books. Maybe a book has multiple volumes.
Wow.
So how many books he has obviously has read, and from there he has, yes, collected all this data.
And the manuscripts, that's right, you know, are really difficult to tackle.
Yes.
Because sometimes, you know, the manuscripts are old, they are ancient, unreadable, you know, they need tasheeh, correction themselves. And, you know, upon reading them, you have to be careful. Some of them are amana. You have to keep the amana very much safe, okay? And return them to the main owner. So how much meticulousness must this man, Amin Allama Abdul Hussein Amini, have? That was a nice story by you, Sayyid Mohsen. Okay, Dr. Fahd Rouhani, any other useful information regarding compiling Al-Ghadi for us by Allama Amini? I know you have ocean of information you yourself, you know, developed. A very beautiful book devoted to the truth, Allama Amini,
yes,
the author of Al-Ghadir, published by The Sun Behind the Cloud Publications. What more information do you have?
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the brothers-in-law of Allama Amini told it, I mean, said it to me, I mean, directly. I heard it right from him in a session. That when Allama Amini was in India, he found a very precious book, I mean, very valuable book, okay, written by a very leading Sunni cleric in support of the imamate of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. when he asked the curator of the library, okay, to have the book just for a few days, okay, the curator of the library found out that it was a seminal book to the project of Allama Amini.
Mm-hmm.
So he denied Allama Amini of this, I mean, facility. Allama Amini became very gloomy. And in his private, I mean, meetings, he used to mention it that, okay, I saw such and such a book in India, but I didn't have any permission, any opportunity,
yes,
okay, to open the book.
Okay.
One day when Allama Amini was walking, I mean, in one of the local markets in Najaf, and wanted to buy something, he understood that the shopkeeper wanted to tear a page of a manuscript, okay, and drop that, I mean, stuff in it.
Okay.
Then Allama Amini got very curious, and because Allama Amini was a tall person,
mm-hmm,
said to that person, okay, bring me that book. You want to tear just a page of it.
Yes.
He looked at it and found out that this is a very precious manuscript of the whole volume.
Mm-hmm.
Then Allama Amini said to that person, okay, don't damage the book. Don't harm the book. Don't damage the book. This is the book I need. Because all shopkeepers in Najaf, okay, knew well about the character and career and the scholarly projects of Allama Amini. The shopkeeper told Allama Amini, I wouldn't receive even a penny from you. I dedicate not only this book to you, but whatever you may want today from my shop. Mm-hmm. All in dedication to Imam Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam.
That's right.
Yes.
So the people around Allama Amini knew that he was concerned with writing and compiling this book.
Yes, and okay, let me tell you something. Allama Amini traveled to London twice. First, in order to check the British Library.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, at that time, he was suffering from an illness.
Okay.
So he couldn't stay that too long in London. He returned back to Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the last days of his life, he was again taken to London for medical treatment.
Okay.
Even if he was, when he was in London, he was in a London hospital over there, okay? He sent someone to the British Library in search for finding a certain book over there.
Okay.
Personally, I contacted that hospital in London, okay? And they certified, they confirmed this piece of information, but they never gave me the medical documents of Allama Amini because okay, all of them are classified over
that's
there.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, that's all right.
One thing just to mention about
okay,
the
very
book.
Good.
Just a quick summary of
very
the
good
book, what this book says, because
yes,
we're just looking at the book as the theological book,
yes,
or a historical,
mm-hmm,
even. In this book, there are different topics which were discussed by,
yes,
or which were obviously addressed by Allama Amini. The first one is obviously the Quran itself. There's no question about it. In regards to the narration...
Sorry, I've got a question regarding Quran. When you say Al-Ghadir from the viewpoint of Quran, what does it mean?
It means the verses that are supporting, and then
uh-huh,
in Al-Ghadir, when Allama Amini is bringing an argument for the wilaya or the succession
uh-huh,
of Imam Ali,
okay,
what verses are there? For example, Ayah Muwaddat is there.
Okay.
قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْنِ إِلَى الْمُوَدَّةِ فِي الْقُرْبَةِ For example. حَبْلُ اللَّهِ الْمَتِينَ What does this mean in the exegesis?
So this is not only limited to Ghadir Khum events.
Only one.
It is about the wilaya, the concept
in
of wilaya.
In Ghadir Khum, the main topic is, is Imam Ali or the infallible Imam, is the successor or not?
Mm-hmm.
In that, when we go to the different verses, for example, the Zamakhshari or Jalaluddin Suyuti, for example, they say Hablullah al-Mateen means Ali ibn Abi Talib, for example, or Ahlul Bayt, or the Prophet. So he proves, like, he brings ayats or the verses as well in order to prove.
Very good.
In the, when we look at the narrations, there are many narrations, and in that he's talking about the authenticity of those narrations, number one. Number two, very important, which is very important, and today if we have disunity, if we have problems in the Muslim Ummah, it's because of these types of narrations which I'm going to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the fake narrations.
Oh.
There are many fake narrations which are related by people throughout the history, maybe some rulers. And it said like, they said like, the Prophet has said like this. For example, one of the fake narrations is that if there is an oppressor who is a ruler, the Ummah should always listen to him because he's a ruler.
Okay.
He's a governor or he's a ruler.
Yes.
Even if he's an oppressor.
Okay.
This is one of the fakest ahadiths because
this seems very much applicable in the Umayyad times and
Yazid
times.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
It was Banu Umayyah who basically came up with this idea to bring many fake ahadiths. So Allama Amini has brought the series of these kinds of ahadith.
And the chain of narrations.
The chain of narrations that these are the fake narrations. Uh-huh. And these were made by different peoples in different time. Okay. So this is the discussion of the narrations. And obviously the fake narrations in regards to the Khilafah. Mm-hmm. Like how Khilafah is superior than the Vilaya and all those things, these things. The second thing is the historical perspective, where he's talking about the Banu Umayyah, how Yazid came up to the, obviously, we can say rulership and all those things. And Imam Hussein, how he obviously came up and he obviously had that, the incident that
These are mentioned in Al-Qadir too?
These are all mentioned in Al-Qadir too. And how Usman, the third caliph, was killed. Who were behind it?
Okay.
What are the narrations? Uh-huh. So this is the historical perspective.
Okay. After that,
he's talking about the beliefs, mm-hmm. the theological perspective, where is like how the ummah is not an infallible. You know, there is a common thing which is in our Muslim brothers. They say ummah as a whole is innocent or infallible. He has rejected this view. Because if this was the case, then why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent so many prophets?
That's right.
Because they were all ummah. So this is one of those topics. So I'm just...
That's all right.
Let me give you the titles of that. And then the ethical issues. The ethical issues are discussed as well in this book. The jurisprudence issues are also discussed in this book. For example, you know, we have this Hajj Tamattu', when people go to the Hajj. They have a Hajj Tamattu, they enjoy another Hajj. You know, at the time of the second caliph, it was said like he prohibited having a Hajj with the Umrah.
Oh, that's right.
And then Imam Ali, at the time of the third caliph, he announced that, I announce openly that whoever will go to the Umrah with me, he can do the Hajj as well. Mm-hmm. So he revived.
Combining the two.
The combining the two.
Okay.
And that was how Prophet did it.
Yes.
So there were many things, obviously. These are the jurisprudential.
And these facts that were tackled by Allama Amini in the book were based on historical facts as well as narrative, we can say.
Narratives, yes.
And the Quranic ones.
We can say like the narrative books or resources. And we have other things as well. For example, the discussion of Rijal. Mm-hmm. Rijal is very important in the jurisprudence. Yes.
The dignitaries or outstanding scholars.
Yes.
That's all right.
So, and after that, obviously, he discussed the linguistic issues as well in this Lughavi
dictionary. This is the main field of the study of Dr. Fakh Rouhani. Really? Al-Qadir tackled linguistic matters? Dr. Fakh Rouhani?
Actually, let me tell you something. Allama Amini, in his magnum opus, Al-Ghadir, highlighted that in the time of the Umayyad and Abbasid rulers, there were some hadith fabrication trends, highlighted all of them, and nominated and mentioned the names of those who ordered such and such a hadith should be fabricated, and those who, dictated those hadiths. Okay?
Okay.
This is one point. Another point is that Allama Amini was not only a scholar in Shia Rijal studies, but he was also an expert in the realm of Sunni hadith scholars. Okay? Mm-hmm. Such that when someone transposed the position of a teacher with a student, in the chain of hadith relators, Allama Amini understood that section of that specific portion of the chain was deliberately manipulated. Okay, and it shows that Allama Amini was very much familiar, with all the details and delicacies of not only the hadith relators in the Shia world, but also in the Sunni world, to the extent that he was able to find out whether the slightest manipulation was deliberately done in the chain of hadiths. This is one point, and another point is that for developing Al-Ghadir, Allama Amini relied entirely on Sunni sources and proved that. By doing this, Allama Amini proved that there have been at least two trends in Sunni hadith scholarship. Mm-hmm. One trend that believed in the personality of the Prophet Muhammad, and the other one who deliberately overlooked and deliberately ignored the personality of the Prophet Muhammad.
Oh, So, and on a, an Islamic trend inside Islamic narration form.
Exactly.
That's
we have, like, there's some people they say, because in the Quran it is said, like, Ana basharun mithlukum.
Uh-huh.
I'm a man like you.
Okay.
So they do not accept the prophetic supremacy of the prophet. They said, like, he's a man like us.
That's right.
And he was just a person who was telling us about the wordings of the God or message of the God, and that's it. No more than that.
That's right. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Fahd Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the book Al-Ghadir, the magnum opus of Allama Abdul Hussein Amini. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Don't forget to visit our website at parstudio.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Around the world with reporters.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the arms trade treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When, following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iya, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Iran, Tehran, the Interior Ministry, the elections office of the country which is now registering the hopefuls for the upcoming June presidential elections. Over 20 public figures have officially announced their intention to run for president, but the final list of candidates will be announced by the Constitution Council on May 27th. This man was the first luminary showing up, Mohammad Hassan Nami, an army general who ministered telecoms during President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told at a brief presser that he has tens of plans for the country's future, especially in the economic fields.
I have 62 programs for my administration when I would be elected. The main six ones will be performed within the first 6 months of my term. It mainly focuses on improving the life quality of people, especially in economic terms.
The next salient figure who signed up on the first day was Saeed Mohammad, another man with military backgrounds who has served as the commander of the IRGC's construction base.
My likely government will certainly abide by the agreements reached by the incumbent administration. So as the 2015 nuclear deal is an international deal, we will comply with our commitments. This is the other side that has withdrawn from the pact unilaterally.
The third one was the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani, who is now serving as an advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Particularly with regard to the public livelihood, people's livelihood. Well, that has so much details, but within 2 years, I will be in contact with different associations, guilds, and the university professors. So I have had face-to-face talks with them in the past 2 years, and that has been delineated on the basis of the facts and realities in the society.
Apart from these three, Wahab Azizi, Secretary General of Jihad Garan Party, and Mohammad Zareh Foumani, Secretary General of Popular Party of Reforms, appeared to announce their bid. Some top political figures are also seen as possible presidential hopefuls, but they have not declared their decision yet. They include former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, Judiciary Chief Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, current Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf, and Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new interpretation of the Constitutional Council of the Election Law says that runners must be between 40 and 75 years of age with at least 4 years of managerial experience with no criminal records. This as the former military personnel must have served as major general. With these conditions in, several of the current hopefuls may be out of the race. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation echoed from Tehran following the deadly terrorist raid on Saturday that killed dozens of schoolgirls in Kabul. Scores of people lost their lives in explosions caused by car bomb and mortar shells targeting a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. Eyewitnesses reported that the victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home after finishing school.
I offer my condolences to the bereaved mothers of the innocent girls who lost their lives in the terrorist attack. I hold the Afghan government responsible for its inaction regarding terrorism and extremism.
We came here to express our sympathy with our fellow Afghan citizens. The fact that the terrorists committed to this heinous crime in the fasting month of Ramadan shows that they have no respect for Muslim citizens.
While Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the Kabul attack, demonstrators here blame the incident on U.S. war of Afghanistan, They say American forces have been on the ground in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But in fact, they've been fueling the flames of terrorism. Last week, the U.S. and its NATO allies began pulling their troops and military hardware out of Afghanistan, a measure which these people say is too late.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it is always after creating chaos and insecurity by finding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it's always after creating chaos and insecurity by funding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
In a gesture of solidarity, Tehran also held this video mapping on its iconic Azadi Tower. The video projection depicted messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation.
A voice to lead, a vision for future. This is the theme for the 2021 World Nurses Day. Iran has commemorated the international occasion as this year, like the previous year, the occasion is marked with a new awareness among the public and officials as nurses, along with other health workers, take the front line in the fight against a deadly coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at a press conference on the occasion, head of Iran's nursing organization, Mohammad Mirza Beghi, said since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the deadly virus, but Iranian nurses have not quit their jobs.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus epidemic, Iranian nurses have been at the forefront of the fight against the disease. More than 100,000 of them have so far caught the virus on duty, out of which 120 died of the virus. On average, 6,000 to 7,000 nurses are under quarantine due to getting infected with the virus. But as soon as they get recovered, they come back to work to take care of the patients. Such a spirit creates a beautiful picture of sacrifice in one's mind.
There are some 140,000 nurses in Iran. For hospital nurses, life under the coronavirus conditions has been much tougher and more challenging. These professional nurses have had to work extra shifts to make up for the shortage of staff.
I've been a nurse for 12 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic was the worst of what I had ever seen. I saw my colleagues losing their lives on a daily basis at the front line of the fight against the virus. Therefore, I decided to take photos of their sacrifices and hard-working efforts to take care of infected patients. My photo was selected by the International Council of Nurses as the best photo of the year in hospital category.
This global COVID-19 pandemic has shown the world the important role that nurses play in keeping people healthy across the lifespan. Therefore, nurses as the largest healthcare profession must play an integral part in planning the future of healthcare.
The World Health Organization designated 2020 as the Year of Nurses to celebrate the contributions of nurses to healthcare during the pandemic and acknowledge the challenges they continue to face as the pandemic ebbs and flows through human community worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The escalation of the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people is awakening the people of the world to the true face of the regime and prompting people from all walks of life to emerge and raise their voices.
The women and the children, we all know, is disproportionately impacted by the violence that is happening in Al-Aqsa. And I think as women that we need to be able to stand with those women in solidarity, and that is why I'm here today.
I think the atrocities of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or a demonstration of insecurity and of awareness that the light at the end of the tunnel for Israel, for a Zionist state, is an oncoming train. For us, it's the daylight. The next phase in the struggle is drawing to an end.
South Africans have always highlighted the plight of Palestinians with numerous marches held to demand a stronger action from the government. While the ruling ANC has taken several policy decisions in this regard, it has largely failed to sign them into law. However, lobbyists are expected to put forward a bill in Parliament that will seek a boycott of Israel.
We want Parliament to discuss it as soon as possible and to adopt laws which will force everyone in South Africa, big business, universities, sports bodies, to have nothing to do with Israel.
The South African government has condemned the Israeli forces' raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the planned evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds. It slammed the move as being in breach of international law and several UN Security Council resolutions. But the country is yet to indicate any plan to downscale ties with Tel Aviv.
The demonstration year forms part of a national day of action in which sister protests have taken place in Johannesburg, Durban and other parts of the country. Protesters say they will continue their action until the government takes decisive steps. Hassan Siriep, Cape Town.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held funerals for civilians killed in Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential areas in different parts of the enclave. The Israeli army launched the attacks on the Gaza Strip on Monday. Children are also among the victims.
My relatives were playing next to their home and the Israeli airplanes hit them and killed some of them. We are really sad, but we are ready to sacrifice anything for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's our right and we are going to grab it from Israel by force, even if we die defending Palestine. We ask the resistance to respond.
God is greater than Israel. I lost my little son while my husband lost his legs. I'm totally speechless and I can't believe this till this moment.
The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Israeli airstrikes came after resistance groups in the Gaza Strip conducted rocket attacks against Israel.
Palestinian resistance will keep defending Palestinians with all means. What is happening in Jerusalem Al-Quds is a crime, and the Israeli regime should get the punishment from Palestinians for attacking worshippers in holy places. Israeli regime is practicing terrorism policies in Jerusalem Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians have gathered here to mourn some of those who were killed in Israeli raids. As Israel keeps bombing and killing Palestinians, people here call on the international community to confront the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Hundreds of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Al-Quds. This was the latest in a series of confrontations in the Holy City. Palestinian worshippers gathered at the mosque's courtyard after performing morning prayers to prevent a planned raid by Israeli settlers later Monday as part of their activities to mark what they call Jerusalem Day. It's the day when East Jerusalem Al-Quds was occupied in 1967 and later annexed by Israel. Israeli forces raided the courtyards, firing tear gas, stun grenades and rubber bullets against Palestinians to force them out of the holy site. However, the Palestinians remained steadfast.
What is going on in Al-Quds is a massacre, a comprehensive war to evacuate the city from its real residents. Palestinians across the world don't remain silent. People in Al-Quds are clashing with the occupation forces to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They will never allow the settlers to desecrate their holy site.
After the clashes, Israeli forces decided to change the path of the Jerusalem Day flag march, so the settlers had to march through the old town's streets. The latest confrontations follow days of clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the Jerusalem Al-Quds. The clashes escalated with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, after Israel tightened its grip on the city and prevented the Palestinians to freely perform their religious duties. Palestinians demand immediate action from Arab states. They say they only approach appropriate response to the crimes is immediate halt of any ties with the Zionist entity.
First of all, the Palestinian leadership must cancel any agreement with the Israeli regime. Then, he should call on the Arab states to stop any effort to normalize ties with Israel. We want urgent measures by the international community to stop the bloodshed in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The tension has also been fueled by an eviction plan in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds, where Israeli settlers have waged a lengthy battle to take over Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts to forcefully evict Palestinians from their homes in Al-Quds. Israel's Supreme Court was to hold a hearing on the eviction on Monday, but the session was postponed due to the unrest in Al-Quds. Israeli violence has sparked